The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
We have
made it
to start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Space Show program, and this is the 16th of January, Martin Luther King Day, Monday, and welcome to our program. Great to be here, and we're going to take an interesting look at presidential transitions and space. But first, a couple of announcements. One sad announcement is that Gene Cernan passed away today. So Gene was 82. He was the last man to walk on the moon, and today, in fact, all of the space shows for this week will be in his both memory and honor. And sad to see him go, but we will miss him. And he was a great one, and the last one to walk on the moon of that era. Let's hope he's not the last one to ever walk on the moon. So hope some people out there get busy. Okay, as for today, there are a couple of announcements to give you. Our toll-free number, for those of you who would like to call us, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also use email, drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. You can also post comments on our blog, and we'll get them almost instantly. So to do that, go to thespaceshow.com. On the far right side, you'll see upcoming shows. Today's program is the first program listed in upcoming shows. Click on it to open up our archive page. Scroll down, and you'll see the area for comments. And if you post a question or a comment for our guest, we will get it almost instantly, and I can read it to our guest on air and get an answer for you, or at least get some feedback for you. So also on our website, thespaceshow.com, there is a menu in the upper left, so do check it out. So under the support menu, that's where we have T-shirts, coffee cups, hats, things of that nature that have the Space Show logo on it. And then there's also the Listen Live button, and that provides information and instruction on how to listen to our programs, both live and via archives. So if you have any questions about that or any of the other upper left menu items, please do let me know. And then on the far right, we've already talked about upcoming shows, but as you see, there's recent shows and other information there as well. There's also a website newsletter, which you'll see adjacent to upcoming shows. And check all of that out. The website newsletter is very detailed, and it has all the information, much more so than the email newsletter for the week's programming. But also, if you scroll down on the website newsletter, once you open it up, you will see who is scheduled for the programs that we are booking in advance. And we're booking through first quarter 2017. And we already have a lot of shows booked through February, March, and April. If you do have guest suggestions, we're happy to field them for you. So send them to us, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do remember that everything we do is archived. You can easily listen to our programs right off of our website or very rapidly download the program. And there is a Support the Space Show and PayPal button on our homepage. You can't miss it. It's over on the right side. And remember, we are a 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. We're a nonprofit. And your support does keep us on the air. Without your contribution, we would go bye-bye. So we thank those of you who do support us and those of you who are about to support us. And remember, if you pay U.S. federal taxes, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you pay state of California taxes, as we are a California public benefit corporation. Visit our parents' website, onegiantleapfoundation.org. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do have sponsors, and there's a couple of sponsorships that are still available if somebody out there would like to be a sponsor for 2017. Email me, and I'll send you the details, drspace@thespaceshow.com. But do read our sponsor banner ads that go across our homepage from time to time. And in addition, the first segment of today's program is brought to you by two of our sponsors. The Space Finance Group is a team of space advocates with crowdfunding experience. Members of our team have helped raise over $1 million through crowdfunding, and we'd like to help you raise the funds you need to get your space project going. If your space idea can be moved forward for under $250,000, crowdfunding can be the ideal solution. We're the only crowdfunding team that specializes in space projects. We understand space. We're the people behind the Integrated Space Plan, and we understand the audience you need to reach, so visit us online at spacefinancegroup.com. You can reach us at j.whitner@spacefinancegroup.com. Remember, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. Also sponsoring us for the first half of our show today is the Space Foundation, and they have their 33rd Space Symposium coming up just around the corner. Connect, engage, and get business done all in one place at the 33rd Space Symposium, April 3rd through the 6th in Colorado Springs, Colorado. The website, spacesymposium.org. And I am moderating a panel of NASA Center directors, so I will be there. In fact, I've already made my reservations. Colorado Springs is small, and it fills up quickly because this conference has maybe 12, 13, 15,000 people attending on a given year. So if you are interested in attending, you want to go to that website, register, get your airfare going. There is an airport that you can fly into at Colorado Springs, or you can go through Denver. But you need to take care of that business quickly, or you will not have any place to stay, and Colorado Springs will be jam-packed. So if you are going, do let me know. I'd love to make an arrangement to meet with you someplace among all those people. That brings us to today's program. I'm very happy to bring back on the space show Courtney Stad. And Courtney manages Washington operations and business development for a 26-year-old leading-edge quality control supply chain software company, TIP Technologies, which supports many of the leading defense and aerospace firms, including New Space Ventures, www.tiptech.com. For the past 38 years, his career path has been a mix of senior government leadership and corporate executive jobs, primarily focused on encouraging the emergence of a competitive commercial space marketplace. And in the government, he's held senior policy and program management positions at the Department of Commerce, the U.S. Department of Transportation, the White House, and worked directly for three NASA administrations. His full bio is on the website. You can read about him. It's much more interesting to talk with Courtney. But he also has been involved with presidential transition teams on space issues before. And since we are still transitioning to the new Trump administration, and not everything is settled on space yet, I thought it'd be good to hear from someone who's been involved before. So, Courtney, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thank you very much. I thoroughly enjoyed the last time talking with you and your terrific audience. So thank you for having me back.
When did you do presidential transition work?
I led the NASA transition in 2000. So during the Gore-Bush protracted electoral issues after that election, when they were trying to decide who ultimately won, I was brought in to lead that transition. We only had a few weeks to do it, but it was back in November 2000 through that January 2001.
Were you only supposed to get a NASA administrator, or what happens when you're working on a transition team like that?
Well, transitions are interesting. They basically are meant as the preview, if you will. You're the landing party, as they call it, that goes in and does the ground truth, does the fact finding. And what you're essentially doing is giving whoever he or she is that becomes the nominee for NASA administrator, you're providing them insight. You're hopefully, if you do your job well, helping them come up the learning curve in terms of insight into the challenges and issues that they would be facing.
What did you do for your transition? Did you actually pick a NASA administrator?
No, we had a rather interesting situation. As I mentioned, we had a rather truncated window in which to do our transition. In stark contrast to the current president-elect, who was able to begin to put his transition teams together right after the election. Again, as many of your listeners know, it was several weeks before, in this case, the Supreme Court decided in favor of Bush. So our window, transition team window, was relatively short. I was blessed by the willingness of a Dr. Scott Pace, who's currently the director of Space Policy Institute at George Washington University, who came on as my deputy in that process. And we went at it. And basically, we had a Clinton holdover by the name of Dan Golden. What happens is that you go in and you have a number of political appointees, what are referred to as Schedule C's. NASA doesn't have a lot of them, but they have roughly around a half dozen or so, mostly in the external affairs part of the agency, but sprinkled in a couple other program offices. So in almost invariably, although we made one or two exceptions during our transition, the so-called holdover appointees expect to leave, and your job is in the transition is to identify those positions and what those responsibilities are. But first and foremost, when you show up at the agency is already prepared, usually a multi-volume set that captures from the bureaucracy standpoint what the major programs, the budgets, what they view as the major issues. And that becomes sort of your baseline. And you're working on behalf of the president-elect. So you hopefully have a sense from the campaign of where that president-elect is coming from in terms of space. And that becomes the initial lens through which you're beginning to slice and dice as you go through that, the product that the agency provides. And from that, David, you are assembling your own customized briefing book for the prospective nominee that identifies the leading personnel, budget, and programmatic issues that he or she would be facing.
So did you, when you were selected to head the transition team, does President-elect Bush call you in and say, Courtney, well, welcome to the team. Here's what I want to do for space. Go out and find the people to make it happen.
What happened in my instance, and I suspect this is more true than not with other transitions historically, is that the president will assign an individual to be in charge of that transition. As your listeners are aware, Vice President-elect Mike Pence is the current head of that transition. In the case of Bush, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney was the head of transition, and he, like Pence, identify a senior official or officials that are the people that on a day-by-day basis, David, manage, and they're the ones who recruit. And in my instance, there was an individual who was quite active, quite senior in the campaign for George W. Bush, who had developed a relationship with me, knew my interest in space, And I had worked actually with Congressman Bob Walker in forming an ad hoc space group during the campaign. And so my name was referred to the appropriate senior official in transition. And then I was given a slot, basically, to fill, because, again, we had a very limited time frame, and was given the leeway to identify and recruit somebody that I had trust in. And I suspect, in my sense from the Trump transition, and again, I want to emphasize, I do not have any formal affiliation with the Trump transition, but I do know a number of the people involved with it, is that it's somewhat similar to what happened with me, that there's an individual that's working down the president-elect, vice president-elect food chain, if you will, who, among other agencies, was handed the NASA portfolio, and they looked around their campaign Rolodex, found an individual that had insight, and as I understand it, that individual, along with one or two others, helped identify the appropriate lead, and through that, they began to recruit what are now, I think, roughly nine or so people that make up the team. I don't know what. That's a number that was true a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if it's held true.
So that was a question I was going to ask you. So from the press, we've seen many people named to the landing team, and they actually seem to be a mix of people representing traditional space perspectives and new space, new commercial space perspectives, kind of almost 50-50 from what I remember the last time I saw it. Did you have a team that was similar, representing a different, of course, the industry wasn't as divided as it is today, but with different segments of the industry?
We basically just had two of us.
Just you and
Dr. Pace.
And Scott,
The two of us.
Uh-huh.
Now, between the two of us, we certainly knew enough people in the community that we could tap for their expertise, but it essentially came down to the two of us. There was also a congressional staffer, or at that point he was a retired staffer, who was invaluable in terms of assisting us. But it really came down just to the two of us. And it is a job that's really bigger than two, but you know, you do what you have to do. And again, we had a very limited window to work it. It did seem to me, reading about the size and diversity of the team, it did seem a bit unwieldy to me, sitting in my armchair. But you know that there have been, over the decades, teams that have as little as mine to as many as nine to a dozen. So you know, it depends on what they think they need. What's interesting to me is that there were some people in our community who were despairing in the days after the election that NASA was not getting any attention, and arguably that is far from the case from the standpoint of the numbers of people in the landing party, and just my sense of the churn going on around the agency. There seems to be plenty of attention being given to it.
Are these positions on the landing team, are these paid positions, and then once the president is sworn in, your job disappears?
They are volunteer positions.
Wow, okay.
And so when you accept the position, you're doing it as a public service. Now, I can't speak to what individual companies may do in terms of payment situation, but I know if you are coming from the Hill as a staff person, you do not get compensation when you're making that shift to the executive branch. And there may be some other university people who may or may not still have some compensation that they've arranged. But by and large, it is done as a volunteer. And you go in with the expectation that it's a very short-term assignment, and that come inauguration day, you revert back to your original assignment. Now, in some cases, you will be asked to stay. In my case, my deputy and I were asked to stay, and I became the chief of staff and White House liaison at NASA. At that juncture, you've got the corporate memories and institutional insight, and so I would not be surprised, David, if at least a couple of folks are not asked
to stay on.
Now, again, if your listeners will allow me for a second, just the mechanics, they're all familiar with the confirmation hearings going on with the senior cabinet level, the Department of Defense, State
right.
Department, and so forth. NASA, although the administrator is a direct report to the president, it is an independent agency. It is not a cabinet-level agency. So normally it doesn't get the attention until after the first tier cabinet agencies are attended to. So usually a few months passes, if not longer. In my instance, almost a year before the administration nominated a successor to, as I said, to the holdover from the Clinton administration, in my case. So during that interim period, administrations being represented by these political appointees I talked to you about, these Schedule Cs. And so in some cases, you stay on an interim basis until a new person comes on, and that person may or may not want to retain you. They may have their own people in mind, or, again, because of your institutional knowledge, insight, you know, you may be asked to stay on for the duration.
What do you hear about the current transition team? Are you only plugged in via the news media? Are they close to having a NASA administrator choice? What do you think is going on?
Yeah. I, again, just based on what I'm reading in the press and just the usual gossip that goes on in Washington, D.C., and for your listeners, just to tell them, I live near the swamp, not in it, but in Maryland, just outside the proverbial swamp. I hear that Congressman Bridenstine from Oklahoma seems to have some traction, but to what extent he's on the short list, I don't know. I know that he's been quite active in pushing for that position, and those of you who follow policy and legislation, you know, he did submit a draft bill last year. I think it's called the American Renaissance Act.
Correct. Is a NASA administrator position typically contentious and confrontational in Congress, like some of these prime cabinet members are getting, or do they usually get a handshake and congratulations after a few minutes of questioning?
Historically, not anywhere near the contention associated with the nominees we've seen in the last week or so. With that said, you know, Congress is taking, for better or for worse, a much more aggressive stance in the civil space program. And there will be members, no doubt, on the Senate Commerce Committee that will have opinions and views, and regardless of party, will express them. But historically, it's been a relatively smooth ride. Now, having said that to you, if you know, the Congress is going to be concerned about the skill and technical background of that individual, and because NASA is a technical agency, so if by chance they nominate somebody without the requisite engineering or science, that's by no means a showstopper, but it will be an issue, no doubt, and that individual will be asked to defend their competence as well as the sorts of individuals that they'll be seeking to complement or supplement whatever skills they might be lacking.
You actually have a listener email from Patricia that is to that effect. Patricia's over in Denver, and she says there has been much talk of different people for the NASA administrator job, but they're not necessarily engineers. Do you think one has to be an engineer or have an engineering either work or academic background to be the head of NASA?
This is my view. Again, having had the honor of working for several administrators, and a little quick little piece of history. James Webb, who was arguably considered one of the finest administrators in NASA's history in the 60s, did not have a formal engineering technical background. Now, he had been associated with some technical organizations, but he surrounded himself by top-of-the-line technical individuals. And Webb, I think by anybody's estimation, had a fantastic political insights and skill. So I think he's the existence proof that you don't necessarily need at the top slot to have that type of technical depth. But you certainly need, as he demonstrated, to have a deputy and others around you who bring that skill and a demonstrated ability to listen and understand the nature of the issues. Now, having said that to you, I won't name names, but I did see one situation where an agency head did not have a technical background, had mostly a budget background. And I think that was a challenge. In fact, your listeners, many of them may recall during the back in the 2000s, there was a issue regarding use of astronauts for additional repairs for the Hubble telescope.
Right.
And there was a decision made from headquarters that we could do that telerobotically. We needed to invest in the appropriate R&D, and we could do it through the telesciences and not use astronauts. I will tell you that led to quite an avalanche of postcards and letters from the American people. But in retrospect, I think the individual, the leader who made that decision, who did not have the technical background, was somewhat sucker punched, if you will, by not knowing the technical challenges. And NASA is a can-do culture. So if you ask a NASA engineer, can you do something, almost invariably, unless it's truly in the realm of the impossible, they will say, yes, sir, we can get that done. So you have to have enough experience and insight to know how to manage. So that's my caveat. Can it be done with a non-engineer? Absolutely. But it needs to be someone special like James Webb, who brought that the total package in the sense of his working in technical operations, understanding the language of the technical world, having great instincts, and being able to be self-aware enough to surround himself with the appropriate people with the appropriate technical skill.
It would seem to me that in addition to having some sort of decent engineering background, that the person ought to be able to have experience on managing 30 or 40,000 person organization or agency or corporation. If you get somebody in there who maybe has been a really successful guy with a 10-person office, and maybe he's been gigantically successful, and maybe he's even an engineer, and going into something the size of NASA, it just seems to me it would overwhelm that person's capabilities.
You're absolutely correct. Depending upon the nature of the organization, it's possible to imagine scaling to something of NASA, again, depending on the nature of the organization. But by and large, you're correct. You need somebody with that depth of experience who has demonstrated an ability to manage a diverse organization. And you have to understand the research culture. NASA is an interesting mix of both research and operations. And you really have to understand the mindset and the culture. You also have to marry that skill to the block and tackle of operating in Washington, D.C. Washington is the NFL in terms of politics. And you have 535 men and women on Capitol Hill who are your oversight, essentially your board of directors, if you will, and they determine ultimately your budgets, and they're the ones that represent the American people in terms of helping to shape and drive the overall program. So you need somebody who can interact well with the White House, the Office of Management and Budget, and the other agencies such as Defense. Also has a handle on the commercial space industry and an appreciation for the tremendous innovation and work that's going on in that area, at the same time that you're dealing with the many, many, many multidimensional political agendas that are up on Capitol Hill. So it's quite an interesting, diverse portfolio that you need to carry as the administrator.
When the administrators say, and I hear people on the space show talk about this all the time, the administrator serves at the pleasure of the president. So I understand the president can fire an administrator, but is that really true, or doesn't the administrator start telling the president what to do and how to do it?
Well, I can only speak to my experience. I have the honor of working on the National Space Council, White House Space Council, under Bush 41 in 1989 through 92. And that's an interesting case study for what you're alluding to, because I understand that the Vice President-elect will be setting up a new White House National Space Council.
Right.
And if I was asked, I'm not, but if I was asked, I would say one lesson to draw from our experience is let there be no air gap between the Space Council and that administrator. We had an instance during my tenure where we were asking the agency, directing the agency to cost out a return to moon. Again, you will recall, David, that President Bush at the time had announced a return to moon onto Mars initiative.
Right.
And we were given the task, we the Space Council, under the leadership of Vice President Dan Quayle, to have the agency cost that out. I'll never forget when the agency, months and months later, came in and the administrator at the time briefed the Space Council and indicated that the cost would be several fold more than the original cost to the moon, the original Apollo landing on the moon, that it led our vice president and the other senior people who were just incredulous. That you were telling the American people that returning to the moon is going to cost some exorbitant large number. And it showed a level of deafness. Well, I recall the administrator tried to appeal our concerns, our opposition, to the president. And the president stood by his vice president, as you would expect, and the Space Council. And that administrator had a relatively short tenure, was ultimately let go. So my advice, for what it's worth, again, is that whoever becomes the administrator, that individual work as closely as possible with the Space Council.
Is it a good idea to reconvene the National Space Council, in your opinion?
I think it is. Our Space Council had a mixed reputation. I think agencies that agreed with our priorities and what we were trying to do cheered us. Others that we had to sort of drag along in certain areas. We took the lead, for example, in opening up the world of commercial space imaging, as one random example. And there were agencies that had equities at stake and were we had to bring them to that policy very reluctantly. With that said, I think there is a need for a space council that can cross the civil, security, and commercial domains. And I'm an independent, so I'm not one of those that's going to engage in any partisan gratuitous critique of administrations or this outgoing administration. But I think you can make a pretty strong empirical case that what they've left in their wake is a pretty fragmented space policy, space framework. And so I think from the standpoint of whether one agrees with or opposes the Space Launch Vehicle and the Orion combination, for example, there needs to be a framework from both a national security and of course, a civil commercial standpoint to put that in its proper context and understand whether the taxpayer is getting the appropriate return or not from it. Same thing with the future of the space station. Number of major initiatives, I think, would benefit from a space council looked at from a multidisciplinary, multi-domain standpoint. And from what I'm reading in the paper, it looks like incoming Vice President Pence may well be one of the most powerful vice presidents we've seen in decades. And he would bring a formidable authority to a space council. And I have a huge amount of respect for Vice President Quayle and the skills that he brought as a leader. But I think Vice President Pence, again, whether or not one agrees or not with the philosophy, but from the standpoint of biography, he brings a level of executive governance and relationships. From what I'm told, on the Hill, on both sides of the aisle, there's respect there that I think could make him a formidable chairman of a space council that could put its arms around our space program in those various domains I referred to. So I think it's a good thing that they're setting it up.
Jim sent in an email from Lexington, Massachusetts. He says, I'm at work, David, so I'm using email. Courtney, there seems to be no shortage of very good space policy ideas and suggestions coming from various segments of the commercial, the new space, and the space advocacy community. David, I'm sure you can attest to this, given you hear from these people all the time as host of the Space Show. Is there any way that some of these good ideas and suggestions can get transmitted to be effective with the transition team? Is there any way just a normal person who knows an enormous amount about the space policy and community and programs and costs and efficiencies can have a voice?
It's an excellent question. And it is a challenge, just to be very candid. The bandwidth that the transition team has is pretty limited. You've got so much information that you're trying to wrestle and put into a manageable form that it is frankly difficult to manage inputs from the community at large. Having said that to you, it is, after all, the American taxpayer who pays for these programs. And so during my tenure with the transition, we made an effort, and certainly could have made a better effort, but we made an effort to try to accept and inputs, those inputs that were articulate and clearly were coming from folks that had some appropriate experience and background and try to at least capture them in some form in this briefing material that we were putting together. But I have to say it is very tough. There were even retired astronauts that were trying to make their opinions heard, and you try your best, but you're really in such a difficult time crunch that it's hard to do it justice. Now, having said that, I think this is a particularly important time for your listeners and those who want to have their voice heard. And there are multiple ways you can try to do that. One is there will be those confirmation hearings. And I think our activist community probably needs to be a little bit more effective than we've proven in the past in terms of getting our questions, our issues, to the Senate Commerce Committee, to their staffs, so we have an opportunity to have our questions raised, if not during the confirmation itself, at least in written form conveyed to the nominee. As your listeners may or may not be aware, you have a couple of bites at the apple with a nominee. One, of course, is the formal hearing when each of the members are given a certain amount of time to ask their questions. But in some ways, more importantly, the nominee is provided with written questions, and they are absolutely expected to provide responses. Now, again, you have a bandwidth issue. You can't hope to get everybody's question asked, but it is one forum that I don't think that we as a community have used as effectively as we might. So I would stay attuned to when that nominee for NASA is named and when that hearing is scheduled. So that's one opportunity. Secondly is again, dealing with the Congress would be through the various oversight committees to make your views heard and ask for your views to be conveyed to the agency. In terms of direct, if you don't know a member of the team, it's very difficult. I'm just being very brutally honest. You can send a letter, you can try to email it, but there's just no guarantee given the crunch of time that it'll be responded to. So I'm trying to think of realistic, pragmatic ways in which one can have those inputs responded to. Another one I don't want to lose sight of course, are the various organizations that many of us are members of. Random example, Planetary Society is a very effective outreach in Washington, D.C., the National Space Society, and there are other aerospace organizations as well that have gotten particularly sophisticated. So they're another mechanism to reach out to both the transition team as well as the staff that will be in place after January 20th. And those groups are listened to, AAA, Aerospace Industry Association, but the other nonprofits I refer to are other ways to convey your thoughts.
Are you seeing any difference in the Trump administration, the President-elect Trump's would-be administration in transition, or is it sort of unfolding in the traditional way?
I would say that this is probably the most uncontroversial thing that a guest has ever said in your program. I think that just about everything the president-elect is doing is unconventional, and I speaking for myself, I think that's a good thing overall. Can't defend all of his tweets, but to say the least. But I think that there is a sense I get that going into NASA, for example, and doing it differently, almost turning the status quo on its head, is sort of the governing principle, and I think that that's a good thing. I think the agency is ossified a bit over its 60 plus year history, and I think there needs to be a lot of sorting the laundry, if you will, in terms of the commercial world vis-a-vis the traditional civil contracted world. I get absolutely the sense, David, that they're going about it in a populating the transition. You alluded to it earlier with people who bring a, unorthodox, in some cases, commercial background, which I think is all to the good, personally. So I think there's every sign that we're going to be seeing some very interesting, unpredictable things that are a vector from the mainstream we've seen in previous transitions. At least that's my sense.
Courtney, we're at our break point, listeners as well, so we're going to take our pause, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes. And hopefully some of you can give us a call if you're not all at work, 1-866-687-7223. And then email remains drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. Back in 3 minutes, everybody.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two. And this is our Monday Space Show program. Our sponsors for this section, Orbital ATK, a global leader in aerospace and defense technologies, is a partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And AIAA is a sponsor. We thank them as well. The American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics is the world's largest professional society. It's pleased to be bringing you Space Show programs. They have over 30,000 individual members. 88 countries are represented, 95 corporate members. Everybody's busy shaping the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology, increasing our knowledge of the universe, and bringing the world closer together. Check them out, AIAA.org. And Courtney, I know you have some things you want to say, but you got a couple of emails, so let me do the emails first. And so George is in Atlanta, and he said, Courtney, not directly associated with space, but definitely deals with space topics, is the NSF. And I'm wondering if you're hearing anything about overhauling how this agency does things, makes grants, decides on this, that, and the other. Many people think that that's a pretty lopsided process and object to the way NSF operates and needs a little cleansing as well. What do you think?
I've heard the same thing over many years about the NSF and how they allocate grants. And you know, I by no means am an expert on that agency, although it's funny, when I was asked to handle NASA, I actually handled NSF for a few days until they had some other folks come in and take over the transition. I hear consistently that there's a lot of concern about inside baseball, quote unquote, whether that's right or wrong. And so I would not be surprised if
the alligators get caught there too, huh?
I would not be surprised.
So it's in the swamp, I guess, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Dr. Doug is in Southern California. And by the way, if any of our NSF listeners are listening today and you want to call us, we'd like your comments on that. And that is, again, our phone number, 1-866-687-7223, and email drspace@thespaceshow.com. So Dr. Doug in Southern California says, I think that space policy is good if it leads to a cost-effective, high-achieving program. Yes, the Space Council could lead to coordination, but why should we assume that will lead to anything other than moderate tweaks of the current status quo?
Based on history, I would say that you would have every reason to be skeptical. In fact, I constantly fight myself to avoid becoming the Diogenes of space in terms of the famous ancient Greek cynic. All I can do, all of us can do, is look at the sorts of people that this president-elect is assembling in the civil space area, and there are at least a couple on the team that I would regard as change agents, just based on their history. In terms of the Space Council, it's what I said earlier. I think you have a vice president that shows the potential, emphasis potential, to bring the level of scope and authority that I think has been overdue. But proof is in the pudding. Proof is in the execution. Everything is on the line with any administration, let alone the expectations that this president-elect has laid out. So I would say to that listener, absolutely be healthily skeptical. But at the same time, I'm to use that overused phrase, I'm cautiously optimistic that we may see some really good substantive reform come out of that council. But
does the Space Council, did yours and does one typically have a feedback loop for people who know what they're talking about, like Dr. Doug, for example? He's a very well-informed advocate. Is there, not where you just send a letter and you get back, thank you for your letter,
right,
and you go kiss my butt.
Right.
Is there a real honest-to-God, honest feedback loop process with these organizations?
Yes, and to the earlier listener asked the great question about how does he get his inputs and his colleagues into NASA, Space Council,
right,
whatever it may be.
Similar kind of question,
I can speak to my experience at the Space Council. We made every effort, I made every effort to ensure that the door was open, that we were open to people who wanted to come and talk and convey their viewpoints. A good part of a given week was devoted to hearing private citizens, organizations, not just the typical industry lobbyists, far from it. I try to, in my case, reach, because I was senior director for commercial space, so I try to reach out to the entrepreneurs, the startups. And then when we had time, I would try to get out and meet people in the community and go to different events and try to network. And so that's at least the way I try to approach it. And I would be hopeful that this Space Council will take a page from our the way we approach things and have an open door policy to folks with legitimate and valid critiques, criticisms, and inputs to be heard.
Are the meetings open where citizens can come in and attend them?
No, they're not unless the council decides to have an open forum, but it's at least in our instance, I don't know whether they'll follow the same model or not, but the Space Council deliberations were done behind quote-unquote closed doors. The Congress expressed some, I think, appropriate consternation about that, and so we worked out an accommodation where we would meet with members and their staff and try to keep it as transparent as possible, but you can never satisfy anybody. The people want access. They want to know what's going on. The problem you have working in the White House world is there's a lot of stuff that's deliberative. There's a lot of discussions that go on with clearances and other things that that if you only get part of the answer to or part of the sense of what's going on, you really do a disservice to the complexity of the overall issue. So, but as I say, you never quite satisfy folks when you're operating in that environment. But we made an effort for what it was worth. We did have several advisory groups that were set up that offered an opportunity for expertise and others to convey their views.
Jack is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he says, not always is a transition from the outgoing to the incoming a congenial one. So to what degree did your incoming transition team, or does any incoming transition team, use their good offices or power to see what the others have been doing and try to uncover wrongdoings?
That's another great question. In our specific case, going back to our 2000-2001 transition, we did uncover an overrun, a major overrun, involving the space station of roughly about $4.5 billion that had essentially been kept secret. And I take pride in the fact that myself and my deputy were able to develop sufficient trust early on that we were able to get that disclosed. The effect was that it accelerated the departure of a couple of senior people who were associated with that information not being disclosed as it should have been publicly, let alone to the transition team. So if you do your job right, you're threading an interesting needle. You're developing relationships. You're trying not to go in and create a lot of havoc and distrust. You're also not in your job is not to telegraph specific policy or philosophy. It's somewhat similar to the old Jack Webb dragnet, just the facts, ma'am. You're trying to get ground truth. What's going on? What are the facts on the ground that you have to deal with, and that the future administrator will be confronting? And if you do it right, folks will be much more open. Not always, but in our case, as I say, we did uncover a couple of major issues, and I can only be hopeful that the current team at NASA is developing the same type of relationship.
Of course, we don't know. So one of my questions would be, and I guess I'll go back to when you were doing this in 2000 and 2001. I assume that our media today, so we're talking 15 years later or so, is really different than even the media that you faced. And there was always criticism of media back then, too. But I my personal opinion is it is very different and has been downgraded over the last 15 years, if that's possible. To what degree did you find that media was hostile or really stupid and dumb, but tried to cover space stories and your work anyway and just got it wrong because they were ignorant? And are you seeing any media issues around space showing up in today's world?
Well, when your job on the transition, let me start answering the question this way. If you're doing your job right, you're not interacting with the media. And I mean no way, not even stealthily or so-called off-the-record background, all those different tricks of the trade. You are doing your job head down, and you're not interacting with the media at all, which leads to frustration to the media. But that's not your job on the transition team. You're there working for your president-elect. Over time, when I, in my case, became chief of staff, your dealing with, of course, the media can't ignore it. At that time, you're right, we had to deal with basically the wire services, several major trade press. There were space reporters who I think by and large at the time were pretty savvy, and by and large, David, with, there are always exceptions, right? But I think by and large we're a pretty good community of professionals. And yeah, they would get it wrong from time to time, but it wasn't through incompetence, but it was just, it happens from time to time, right? With exceptions today, I think that with the emergence of social media, it's much more difficult. People are opining all the time. There are all sorts of factoids that become the basis for news stories. I've noticed in the mainstream press, several of the mainstream press would say certain things about transition that I knew just to be wrong, or they would state as fact that a certain individual who was orbiting around the president-elect influenced putting certain people in the team, and I for various reasons I just knew that was just wrong. So it suggested to me that it just didn't have very good sourcing. And I think the technical illiteracy of a number of the folks covering the program is probably not as good as it once was. Now, having said that, I still think that the journalists that cover space news and certainly Aviation Week still have a pretty commendable bench.
The traditional, yeah, the traditional seems to be really good. It's the new stuff coming up and the alternatives and all the people opining, as you just mentioned, and then some technical blogs that you see, you know, like Reddit and others that come up, and you really don't know what the background is and who these people are that are writing and editorializing or relaying facts to us.
That's absolutely correct, and I would urge your listeners to really look at the, you know, I have no equity in any of this, but just what I do, I tend to see what Space News is saying online, and you know, there are a number of mainstream reporters like Joe Auerbach of the Washington Post who more often than not gets it right. Even NASA Watch is useful because the gentleman that manages that does a pretty good job of tracking the major issues, and if you read the comment sections, you'll get at least a sense of how far off or how right a particular issue might be.
Would you like to be doing it all over again and doing this for the new administration, or are you glad not to be involved in it?
Glad not to be involved. I prefer working in the private sector, the commercial world, and it is going on 17 years later. I'm that much older, and it's a bit of a young man's game, so I'm very happy to cheer and provide whatever informal advice I can from time to time to the people working it. I was really honored to have the different jobs and positions that I had and help, however modestly, help advance the ball on this commercial world in particular, let alone other civil. But I'm involved in several commercial space-related ventures right now, and that's what I'm floats my boat right now is staying involved in the commercial world, and like all of us listening to the program, hoping that this new administration not only does no harm to the commercial space policies that have built up over the last several decades, but builds on them so we have the type of strong American-led civil commercial security program that we need to have in place, so that one day you and I, David, can be having this phone call somewhere in space.
Well, you're going to have to hurry up.
You and me.
When you were doing this commercial space work, and again, we're going back to 16 years ago or so, maybe longer, did you think that commercial space and I'll add in new space would evolve and look like it does today? Or what did you think it would look like 16 years later?
I would have expected that it would have accelerated much faster, that we would have seen more the commercial crew to the space station would have greatly advanced at this point, that we'd be well into it at this point. I would have anticipated a replacement for the space shuttle so that we were not reliant on the Russians today for accessing the space station, which I think is just outrageous. It's not just because it's the Russians, but having us dependent on any foreign entity, I think I have no issue with alliances, no issue with working in partnership with our allies when it comes to space. We can't do it all ourselves. But to have that level of reliance, I think, is outrageous, frankly. And I would have expected that my friend Bob Bigelow Aerospace, I work with him in full disclosure, I don't now, but years ago, that those inflatables of his, and many of you listeners know he has the so-called beam that's connected to the space station as we speak, that I would have anticipated that he would have full-blown commercial habitat, a commercial space station, if you will, today orbiting and laying the groundwork for his vision, which is to have these habitats on the moon and other surfaces. I would have thought we'd be further down the road in proceeding down that road. With that said, I'm very optimistic in terms of the incredible work that SpaceX and its technical team is done, and it looks like they're recovering from the explosion of a few months ago with this most recent launch. Jeff Bezos is in a very methodical tortoise fashion, I think, laying the groundwork for some outstanding low-cost access to space. Again, I have no connection with either one of those, but from what I'm reading, and I do know some of the people involved with both, and there are a number of other companies out there. The Holy Grail, low-cost access to space. It's holding us back, has held us back for decades and decades. And if you'd asked me back in 2001 that we'd be still lagging in that area in 2017, I would have been incredulous. But here we are. So I can only hope that the next several years these commercial efforts are going to continue to be successful, and that the Congress and the administration will work together. It's so vital because Congress has had a voice, and sometimes a constructive one, sometimes not, and that the executive and legislative branches provide the framework that allows the commercial world and the civil to blossom. I guess it's the nature of those of us, David, in this business that we are optimists by just the nature of being space, passionate about space advocacy. But I tell you, when I think back when I was a kid watching 2001 in the late 60s, again, I would have fully expected to be on the moon in one of those modules having this conversation with you, and I would not have expected we'd be as still at the bottom of the gravity well.
Why do you think that's so? Where did we go awry, or did we have unrealistic expectations?
First of all, when it comes to American ingenuity, the world is the limit. I think that we just ended up going down different paths with NASA building space shuttles, and not saying that was a bad thing, but it became sort of a huge investment, and we didn't take the steps that we should have as a nation to nurture the entrepreneurship, And I remember, I've been in the business long enough to remember where NASA's immune system would be activated in earnest with any commercial effort, such as launches
or they'd fight
satellites.
Back.
When I first got into the business back in the late 70s, early 80s, it was a real nightmare dealing with the agency. Now, we have people in some senior positions who are being proactive in terms of commercial space, but frankly, there needs to be a lot more change on the culture side. There needs to be much more reliance on the services side, relying on the commercial launch services side of the industry, and get NASA focused on space exploration, and figure out important functions such as earth science, aeronautics. Those are very important programs, and I would add, I think those are important priorities for a space council. Because I, for one, am just getting tired and fed up. Every 48 years, we have these debates over the future of earth science and NASA. And where should aeronautics go? Well, let's make a decision. Let's get together. And as a political collective, both the administration and Congress, make these are hard, difficult decisions. But make them and move forward.
What are your expectations for space now with the new administration, or are you just totally up in the air? You don't know what to expect.
I have one. I keep hearing informally that there's great concern about the exposure of our assets in low Earth orbit. The Chinese, of course, and for that matter, the Russians have engaged in some activity that it gives one pause for concern, because we have a rather asymmetrical situation. Much of our battlefield and our men and women in uniform are dependent on the navigation, communications, imaging systems that are in orbit, much more so than our adversaries. So both the ground segment, space segment are quite vulnerable to attack. So I'm hopeful that this administration will give focus to protection of those assets, ensuring it remains a peaceful, stable environment. Because, like many of us, I'd like to see the low Earth orbit become primarily a commercial domain, obviously making room for some of the security assets we have up there, but primarily a commercial realm, and have our tax dollars focused on exploration. I happen to be a I know this is going to be chagrin to some of the Mars advocates among your listeners, but I think that let's get to the moon again. Let's establish ourselves there. Let's use that as a test bed as we look at venturing out into the solar system. And frankly, what I'd like to see, this is me speaking, is rather than these little steps, these little incremental steps, that we have a policy that is really visionary, that looks at looking at human settlements and exploration throughout the inner solar system, with the U.S. Working in partnership, but in the lead with our allies, and putting in context those stepping stones, be it the moon, be it whatever planet, or L1, L2, if you're a space colony advocate, but begin to really, really think big and huge. And do that, and I think you'll absolutely enlist the great visionaries like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. I mean, look at Elon's time frame. Whether he makes it or not, he has no patience for going to Mars in 2030. He's looking to do it in a few years. Whether he does that or not, the point is that he is in the best tradition of American entrepreneurship, which is marshal the resources, be as innovative as possible, and get the job done. And frankly, with all due respect to some very, very, very fine people who work in the agency, NASA bureaucracy, time is often not a big driver, and resources, although you do live in a budgetary constrained environment, nonetheless, there's always next year, and there's always money to be appropriated or whatever, but when you're an entrepreneur living in the private sector, it's a different dynamic, and I think we've missed that, and I think it cost us these past going on half a century in terms of the progress that we frankly should have made by this year 2017. So I'm hopeful this new administration will begin to take advantage of the assets in the commercial world and work with the men and women in the civil security world and really begin to accelerate our future in space. It's way, way overdue.
You have another question from Dr. Doug again in Southern California. GEOCOMSATs are a clear example of commercial space, and yet that hasn't obviously led to the establishment of bases off Earth. To what extent do you think that other commercial space developments will lead only to the development of those areas as opposed to being a path to breaking out towards settlement?
Well, it's a cliche, but I have to say that it's that holy grail. It's that low cost. I think Jeff Bezos is absolutely right when he says that that you know, much of our vision for developing space settlements and so-called space industrialization will continue to be impeded until we can radically reduce that cost. And it really is only, unfortunately, in recent years that we've had individuals with the substantial resources in a position to seriously engage the issue of building low-cost vehicles. And I think once we see that come to fruition, then I think Dr. Doug's vision of moving beyond into the world of space settlements and so forth become a realistic possibility. The tragedy is that those of us of a certain age, David, remember decades ago having this very same conversation. I like you, no doubt. I've been to endless conferences. I've read endless papers. I've been the subject of endless exhortation, and I've made a few speeches of my own over the years about getting that cost to get out of the gravity well down. And I believe personally that if we had been more proactive in the government and working with the entrepreneurial sector, that through trial and error and a lot of failures and so forth and missteps inevitable in this very complex, unforgiving space realm, that we would be indeed having this conversation on the moon or L1 or L2. And I think we were greatly impeded. But that's history, and we are where we are. And I'm hopeful that we'll see progress.
I'm going to challenge you a little bit on what you said.
Sure, go ahead.
Because I think there were some things that happened later rather than earlier in that timeline you're talking about that changed the way people started thinking about this. And when those changes came about, advances started happening toward getting lower launch prices and people stepping up to the plate who had resources to get things done rather than being dependent upon the system. So for all of those years that you were working and talking about it, it was largely rhetoric and talk because there wasn't any action being taken to do anything about it. But I remember when I started the space show. So I started it in 2001 in June, just before 9/11 hit. But the following year, at a Space Frontier Foundation meeting in Los Angeles, I met this nobody who was out there talking to anybody and everybody about his ideas to go to Mars. And this was Elon Musk. And he gladly came on the space show. He was looking for any forum, and he came on many other times as well. Now, then I guess he's too busy. But in any event, his thinking, and he got his message out, started to make a change in how people saw things with commercial space. And then when he said, I couldn't get a rocket to do Mars Oasis. It was all too expensive, so screw it. I'm going to go build my own rocket company.
Right.
I mean, that altered everything. I mean, even though it took him years to get a rocket and to, you know, almost failed with Falcon 1 and all of that. I mean, that was such a huge difference from rhetoric to action. And that, I think things like that, and then Bigelow stepped up to the plate. And Bigelow initially wanted to have cruise ships orbiting the moon. And he doesn't talk about that anymore. But those were his earlier ideas, like Queen Elizabeth II would be orbiting the moon, and people could go for cruises around the moon and land on Mars for the moon for excursions and stuff like that. These people had the resources to take action, whereas it wasn't anymore just rhetoric. And they didn't come along, Courtney, until, you know, the old saying, changes show up when they're ready to show up.
I'll say this to you, though, that in many ways, Elon and company were riding on the shoulders of a couple of people I'll mention. May not be familiar to your listeners. David Hanna was a not of the billionaire status of Elon, but he had quite a lot of wealth, and he was behind that Space Services effort back in the early 80s, 81, roughly.
With President Reagan, that's right.
And did launch, at that point, a suborbital rocket. I was with the company in Silicon Valley, and our president was the first president, actually, of Apple Computer that was imposed on Steve Jobs and Wozniak, and he provided our initial capital for what at that point was a water-launched rocket. And there were a number of others, Gary Hudson among others, that were pushing different concepts. But it takes me back to my earlier point to your audience that they're really, although the administration at the time and Congress was beginning to embrace commercial space, there was a tremendous amount of opposition. The contractors at that time viewed with disdain a number of these small wannabe companies, as they refer to us. So by the time Elon is showing up in your program, not only does he have the wherewithal and the contacts to begin to put the funding in place for his audacious concept, but remember too, he's also benefiting from decades of
stuff that went before.
Right,
absolutely.
And I'm only making the point that if we had been more receptive as a nation, and if the agency had not been so hidebound as it was in the late 70s and early 80s to a number of these entrepreneurial ventures, we might have had a different and more positive dynamic. That's all I was saying. It might not have taken so long for the Elons.
Yeah, I agree, but that isn't the way the history unfolded, and what it took to shake it was the Musk and the Bigelow.
Absolutely right.
They're the ones who busted all of this crap wide open and changed the zeitgeist of everything to start this as being plausible. And Musk had lots of opposition. I don't know as much about Bigelow, but remember Bigelow had to go to Russia to launch his two test modules.
Yes, I was working with him at the time.
And he almost couldn't do it because of a hostile ITAR environment. And so it took people of that wherewithal and stature and resources to bust through on the entrepreneurial side to start changing things. And yeah, of course they were built on the shoulders of giants that you know came before them, but I think that they're the ones that started this new age of being able to really think that this was all going to be possible, and we could lower launch cost, and we could have back then it was called alternative space. We could have an alternative space environment with new commercial companies, and we could make money in it. And these guys were showing the way, and then more and more stuff started to show up on the coattails, and eventually miniaturization showed up. And you know, you could look at the timeline for what came in, but
And their counterparts, not just launch, but in the satellite imagery.
Yeah, that's a miniaturization. When I started going to SmallSat conferences, which I'm sure you're familiar with, there were 350 to 400, 450 people there. Now there's 1,500 people there.
Yeah.
You know, over the last several years.
Yeah.
So things have changed, and now the momentum for change, I don't believe is stoppable. I don't think the new administration could stop it, even if they wanted to do it. I think it's too on its way and is going to continue that way.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, I hope you're right, because a lot's riding on it. And I think you're right. I think it is unstoppable. And we're very lucky to be living in an age with Elon's and the Jeff Bezos and others, Richard Branson and company. Hopefully, David, we'll live long enough to see these different audacious visions come to fruition, and get us to where I'd hoped we would have been 20 years ago. But
we couldn't do it 20 years ago.
I hear you.
And I was recently asked to do an interview on deep space mining for Esquire magazine, and I don't really know a whole lot about it. But the one thing I stressed was the quality of the management that's involved in the two companies that are doing this. And, you know, from a business perspective, I look at the people involved, and they have first-class risk takers and business people who know how to do something like this, even though it may be 30 years in the future or 20 years.
I have to tell you, ranging from the sponsor of one of your sponsors tonight to on this program to the management and the overall financial community, very sophisticated. You and I are old enough to have lived through several waves of the space entrepreneurship.
Right.
And I must tell you that I could not agree more. I think that the savviness of the people behind these different ventures is
first class.
Breathtaking.
Yeah,
first class, absolutely.
So they may be long timelines, they may be full of unknowns and risks, but with quality management, if I had the money, I would bet in their favor. I might not be around to see it, but I would absolutely bet in their favor because of the quality of people you have coming into it, and I think that's a plus for taking commercial space on into the future.
And by the way, the good news is that I understand that the NASA transition team has been reaching out to some of these commercial space groups. I don't know the exact names of the people, but I take solace in the fact that they are reaching out to these change agents out there in industry.
Any summary, any closing comments, any things you'd like to leave with us for today, any forward-looking things for the Trump?
Well,
recommendations for the Trump group?
I think, and obviously we have a very controversial president-elect, to say the least, but for those of us who are united by our support for space and, frankly, frustrated many times by the future, I'll leverage off what you were saying, David. I think that these are really can be a golden time in terms of the range of entrepreneurs that are devoting their lives to building the rockets and the spacecraft needed. I think that at least sitting in my armchair, I see some positive signs that some really good people are engaging on the NASA side, who also would agree with us about the need to partner up with the commercial world. So I've been disappointed before, but I see some signs just in the space portfolio that tell me that if we're back on discussing legacy in the space area a few years from now, I think that I see more positive than not in terms of the future of this country. And of course, a lot rides on those people you were talking about, their ability to continue to make progress, and when they hit the inevitable problems and mishaps, as Elon has, for example, they are as agile and recover as quickly as he's demonstrated he can. So from that standpoint, I'm very much an optimist.
And I join you. And Courtney, I look forward to talking to you again. Maybe later in the year, we can check in and get a report card on how things are going.
Always a joy, and also want to join you again in condolences to Gene Cernan. He was an absolutely great man, hero. I had the honor of working with him on a couple of projects, and his family. It's a great, great loss.
Absolutely, and all our shows this week, listeners, are in both his memory and his honor for being such a great person. Courtney, thank you, and until the next time we talk, take care, and good to be with you again for this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, that's it for today, and lots of shows this week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Hotel Mars, Friday and Sunday. Check out the newsletter on the website or upcoming shows or the email newsletter. And everybody have a great week. Keep looking up. Goodbye from Courtney, David, and the Space Show.